Okay, we are calling to order the Administrative Control Board meeting for Mountain Regional Water for June 15th, 2023. Is there any public for public input?
There is not.
Okay. We have all been waiting for this with bated breath. Let's hear about the audit.
So excited, right? Even by the time my parents are all old news. Report. Okay, so I was going to kind of go through some high points with that on an old page. I don't know, are you going to compare their?
Yeah, there are hard copies too, if anybody would like one to look at.
If you just want to tell me what page you want to go to.
I mean, I should say the first few pages of that are what we call a letter of transmittal. And it's just it's a lot of verbiage about different things, your grades, different issues that the district is facing, things like that. And then when we get to page 13 of the PDF, your 13 is something different than my 13.
That's the.
I meant of the PDF, not the page number. The transmittal, not number, it's a letter. So there we go. So in there, it's three pages, but this is just our audit report. And that's what I kind of wanted to mention. And we just included what would be called a plain opinion saying that the financial statements are fairly stated in accordance with the U.S. GAAP. And then there's a lot more verbiage in there about responsibilities that we have during the audit release management. Not the main point, it's just that there are no findings the financials are in accordance with GAAP. And then the next several pages, like from 428, I didn't write it down, but through page 28 in the PDF is what is referred to as management's discussion and analysis. And it presents some of the summarized financial statement information and some narrative about the things that took place during the year. But then I was going to have to go to it's page 30 in my copy of the PDF, the statement of net position. It's page 18 in the hard copy. That one. So this one and the next are your balance sheet. And for the most part, a lot of what's in there was really similar to last year. There wasn't a lot that I was going to call out other than our favorite things, the net pension asset or liability, everything related to the pension was to help us all. It is the nuttiest thing that is required to be, is reporting purposes only. So we adjust either a net pension asset or a net pension liability. In 2022, it was a net pension asset because they did the valuation as of December of 2021 when the market had gone crazy. So the market was really high, returns were going to be high, everything was like, you know, from a long-term standpoint, kind of overfunded, for lack of a better word. But then here we are in 2022, everything's gone down, so next year it'll probably swing again to being a net pension liability. It's just this kind of ridiculous thing that the GASB decided we need to report on. But the main thing I would emphasize with this is it's really reporting only. It's just this financial statement mess. It doesn't actually change your funding. The funding is still based the same way as always. And particularly here in Utah, the pension funds are in great shape. They're not, there's other states where they're going to get bailed out, you know, whatever, the pensions are a mess. But here, it's not a big of a deal because this reporting that we have to do just fluctuates kind of wildly, but your funding will just be the same as always. Your budgeting won't need to change, even if there are these kind of wild swings in the budget. So that was really the main thing I wanted to point out. We've got this net pension asset on that page, and then last year we had a net pension liability. So to see that big swing is just kind of odd, but also kind of like not worth worrying too much about. And then the other thing I was going to mention, we have a new line item this year on the assets called right to use lease assets. And then in the liabilities, there is an item called lease liabilities. This is a new animal, thank you to the GASB as well, where if you have a lease that would have typically been just you pay rent every month for, say, a backhoe or something. Used to be just rent expense. Now they want to capitalize as well as formulas to kind of figure out if it's based on, you know, the net present value of their cash flows. So they want to book an asset and liability. So we did all that. It's not very material. It didn't really have any big net effect on your equity. So we just did it to, you know, behave and do what we're supposed to do, but it wasn't a big deal. It shows up in all these different things I was going to mention. There's a new footnote related to it. I don't know, that's not there yet. I'll point that out in a minute. Anyway, so that's just kind of a strange animal that's new this year. On the next page, we can go down, and I was just going to mention your debt. Again, here we show, let's see, is that
previous page?
So you can see kind of in the middle of the page, it's net pension liabilities, zero this year, but that was all balanced there last year. It'll probably just reverse in the next year. And then in your notes and bonds payable, really the only large activity was issuance of the debt to purchase the land for the building. So that was kind of a big change there. And then I was going to just mention, I mean, there weren't any just huge, crazy swings or anything in the profit and loss on the next page, other than your impact fees went back to a little bit more normal because like 2021 is so out there. So, and I know you've got wild swings in that world and everything going on too. So that's kind of reflected there. Or that I can pause here, just kind of getting through those financials. Are there any questions yet? Or just can point out a couple of footnotes? No? Okay. Let's go to page 45 in the PDF document. Page 33 of the hard copy. This is just a note. I just want to like print this out because it just spells out what the restricted assets, the restricted cash and cash equivalents consist of. Like it's always kind of, you hate to see people think, oh, we've got all this cash, but not all of it is just available for the day to day. We're supposed to spell out what some of the cash is for. A lot of it's related to bonds, you know, the one that's going to require the impact you reserve that you guys track every year so you know what we can't spend out of that. So that's just one thing I wanted to point out. The next page down is the footnote that's related to this right to use lease assets is leasing. And so it points out that we've got leased machinery and equipment. And I know there's what, a couple of backhoes.
Yeah. Remember skid steer and a backhoe.
Yeah. And then this office space too that you haven't that you're just leasing for now. So now it kind of looks like you own it sort of as an asset. It's like a pretend asset thing you got. So, and then I don't know if you want to look at the pension chart with more detail. It's, it gets down to like page 64. We're all pretty clear that it's just kind of a big mess and it's not necessarily worth getting into the weeds. But you guys, it's so good. It's, theoretical, crazy things that you have decided to do just here. So,
Karen and I, we always go over it once.
Yeah, we just, yeah, every year I go, what's that? Oh, I mean, just so you guys know, I'm not sure I've really shared. You see the calculations, but the calculations for it are all done at this URS level. Like, if I had to dig in and do all this, you know, fire me, I'd just quit. Be a bartender or something, I guess. But like, I just couldn't even do it. You know, you read through everything you have to do, and the actuarial evaluations and everything. It's so complex. But we, what we do to kind of say we're going to rely on URS information is we get what is called a SOC 1 report. It's a audit of the URS internal controls and such. And okay, another GPA firm does that. And they say, okay, all their controls are working. They do all these tests of their controls. And we take a look at that and make sure there are no findings. And we can kind of say, okay, we're relying on their system. And then they provide us, you know, basically with this report saying, here's what we've done to come up with all these numbers. And so that's what we just, that's kind of our test work from that is relying on their controls. So like I say, next year it's going to swing again. That's really all I had in mind to point out in terms of specifically on the financials. Let's see, did you want to talk about anything more? Or does anybody have a question?
No, I just thought that the operating revenues or net income stayed about the same because even though we dropped in impact fees, we picked up some other things. So, and it came pretty, we were better than budget last year. As we normally are, you know, just to be conservative, because it's always easier to not go do a budget amendment to change profit and loss, let's say. So, it's always great to work with Dana, and I think we have a good team here between Sharon helps out a lot, and Lisa's always there to help out and look over things too.
Yeah.
If we get stumped on anything, or need another opinion, so.
Absolutely. I mean, really, I would just reiterate that. It's just such a great audit to work on. You guys do such a good job. And the information, we just get it quickly and easily. And it's been really, really great to work with you guys. To that end, you want to go to the other reports that we have? We've got one that is called the compliance reports that kind of have a header, sort of have a cover letter, it's 5 or 6 pages.
I think it should be at the very end of this. I thought I combined it all.
Oh, did you combine
it? It might be at the very end.
Oh,
yes.
That's one. Okay, so this set of reports is just what we refer to it as our compliance reports. For every audit that's a government auditing standards audit, we have to issue a report on internal control and compliance with like laws and grants and things. So we go through and do, we gain an understanding of the internal controls of financial reporting. We do not express an opinion on it. We don't say we haven't tested controls, we haven't done enough to actually inspect an opinion, but we just say nothing came up that we would consider a significant deficiency or material weakness. Basically, we talk about the controls, we do some testing. I can't actually use the word testing, but we kind of review some of the processes to make sure the processes are being followed. And we haven't come up with any findings there. So like, no news is great news. And then the other part of it is just talking about compliance on the last page. And the compliance, what we do is we kind of look at big picture things that you need to be doing. Like, are you making your payroll deposits timely? Some things like that. If there are big grants, if you're getting federal grants, certainly we'd look at kind of grant agreements to see what is required. And then we also have an audit guide from the state, which we can look at that as the next page. So the state gives us a list of different things we have to test. And every 3 years, we have to test more things. We're in kind of an in-between year this year. So all we have to look at are those three items there, the budgetary compliance, the fraud risk assessment, which I know you guys all go over, and then also just your fees, the building up truck fees and everything. In all that, we didn't find any issues or anything we needed to report in this year as well. So it was, again, really just good news. I can't remember if next year will be the year where it will be the more expanded, more items tested that you guys have all the controls and stuff in place where those things have never been an issue. And then I guess maybe the next page is the last report kind of thing we have. Yeah, this is what we refer to this as a letter to those charged with government to you guys. And we just kind of, it's kind of a boilerplate report that we just have to speak to a few things. One is the significant accounting policies, but just in a particular footnote in the financials, and there were we mentioned this year that we did adopt that GASB 87 with the pretend right to use leased assets. I don't have any strong opinions about the GASB. And then we speak to accounting estimates, and the main one we mentioned here, the URS, all of this stuff was related to the pension liability and such is based on estimates, and it's just part of the nature of preparing financial. Similarly with depreciation, all depreciation lives and approach to depreciation, that's really call that out. We mentioned certain footnotes that are kind of sensitive or important. One of them is the note 4, which I mentioned to you, is restricted cash, just so you're aware of what cash can't just be spent on odds and ends. And then note 7 and 8 talk about your long-term debt activity and also outline what revenues are pledged to pay that debt. The rest of this is pretty basic. We didn't encounter any difficulties during the audit. There were no misstatements or audit adjustments that didn't get made, or we didn't find anything that was material. That's part of the audit anyway. We had a few little things that we just talked about, made a few changes, but it was nothing like huge that we had to make just because of the audit. We didn't run into any disagreements with management, and as Steve stated, it's always just great. You guys are awesome to work with. basically, that's it. There were no other findings to report. And so if there's anything, you know, that we needed to like know about, it would either be in here or a separate management letter. We don't have one to issue. So with that, I would just say, well done. The simpler, the better on these reports. So it's fantastic to not have anything to report. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we should be concerned about? And that they don't know about you, not you.
No.
Is there anything we should be concerned about?
In terms of what? Internal controls, financial statements, things like that?
Yeah.
Well, like I say, from an auditor standpoint, I have to say, we can only give negative assurance, right? We can't say, yeah, everything's perfect. There could always be fraud that could pop up. People could be colluding. You just never know. So there's no way that I can say, no, everything's totally perfect. No worries at all. But for what we do see, the internal controls that are in place and working are proper. They're working well from what we've seen. Like I said, we didn't test them, so I can't really share an opinion. But what we've seen, they're set up well. And for the size of staff that you have, there's good division of responsibilities. So different people handle different things so that the likelihood of any kind of collusion or fraud is minimized. But there's definitely no guarantee.
You have any concerns about our assets versus our liabilities?
No, I mean, this continued. I know you guys are super aware of dealing with inflation and everything. I know cost is a complicated meet. And but the good news is you guys are super proactive, given the great study, so you can manage your revenues, bring in those assets in order to get those liabilities paid for. And you definitely have really good reserves with the impact fee reserves. So,
what about our investments? Are we conservative enough?
Yes. Okay. Anything in the PTIF is super. It's as conservative as you can be aware of. It's like we were talking about. They don't give you the best disclosure in the world, but they have to follow state law. And so, and state law is designed to be conservative. And so, unless you're not out there investing in corn futures or something. So,
Bitcoin.
Do think that PTIF is really, really, it's safe. It's hard to dig into and know exactly what's in there, but it's definitely designed around the bottom.
And one last question. Is there anything in it, anything that concerns you?
No. We would have, if there was anything that concerned us, we would have written it in the report. Like, okay, that don't take that as a guarantee that nothing could ever happen, you know. Seen it a couple times.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. Anyone else?
Yeah. Thanks for the relationship. You did such a great job.
It's so great to hear you guys.
And it's a testament to Steve.
Yeah, totally.
Having all this in order and ready to go.
Yeah. You guys did a fantastic job. It's always fun to come up. It's so nice to be out of my office. And I thought, all right, chaos central there. So anyway, appreciate it. And I'll just get out of here. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll leave out for a second.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. You too. Looking forward to you, right? Yeah. Good luck.
Okay, so with that, we're going to move on to the Signal Hill Water Treatment Plant Optimization.
Yeah. We got pulled up because PowerPoint.
Yeah, it was.
I don't like that.
That's a stat. Crazy.
Yeah, that's not. Here we go. You want to hand that to him?
Thanks. Okay, so we got Will Porter here with Jacobs. We appreciate you making time for you. He's been part of our project team up at Signal Hill for the past couple of years. Jacobs, as everybody knows, is our treatment consultant, our pre-qualified engineering treatment consultant. We've been working together with the district since about 2020. And obviously they have a firm, you know, they have a big national, international presence even, but locally, they have a really good team, in my opinion, that's done optimization work at Quinstrum for water treatment plant, taking the lead at Drinking Water Treatment Plant, and starting to do some work with Central Utah as well.
Yeah, Central Utah, and Laura Walsh, yeah.
So, with that, I guess we can go over this. So you guys have already seen this in the board packet. This is just a brief overview. Quick duties. This first section, just kind of a quick recap. It's essentially what we looked at last board meeting with the Bowen Collins folks. This is where we're sitting at now currently with our water resources. And then if we look at it graphically, which is the next slide, it's a little bit easier. This curve is the exact curve that we were looking at last month, but the most conservation, the most aggressive conservation baked into the projection as possible. So we're showing we're dipping into our safety factor, duty factor, variability, however you want to quantify that. Currently, we're going to catch a break when our summit water delivery comes off the table. And then in 2028, it's looking like we need to plan for source development.
So are we actually going to have any trouble this year or next year?
I hope not.
Okay.
So that brings us to this current effort, this current project. As most of you guys remember, Corey, you weren't here, but in November 21, we kind of started a big picture treatment plant project. And we actually approved the scope of work to design a full expansion. When I say full expansion, I mean it's matching the capacity of the lost communities. After which we decided to take a step back, reevaluate all of our options, which we've been doing for the past year and a half or so. And one of the options we've really been investigating is purchasing water from Park City through a proposed interconnect project. So we're going to look at that as part of the presentation. So with all the feedback we've gotten, instead of a one large full expansion project, the intent was trying to break it into two phases we're going to call them throughout this presentation. So it's kind of dull naming convention. But the intent was having a phase that was going to be a little bit more manageable and kind of get us through our short-term hurdle, reliability, redundancy, water quality concerns. And then phase two, evaluate, you know, the big picture. How are we going to go get to build that? We saw in that last chat, we finally have a roadmap now. We know where we're going. We know where this build-up is. So how can we make the plan to be there? And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. And then just as kind of a preface or overview, we're not asking for any board decision on this at this time. This is just more information as we make progress in the master planning and a great time to capture any comments that the board may have. And we'll take those and continue to make progress on our master plan and future work up the plan. So I'll switch over to Will. He can kind of guide us through the rest and highlight the Jacobs work they've been doing past
year. Thanks, Sam. Yeah, so I'm Will Porter with Jacobs. I'm a water treatment process engineer. I've been with Jacobs for about 8 years. I've also been working with Sam recently on this project. Thanks for having me. First board meeting, pretty exciting. As Sam mentioned, we've got two different phases here, and we're evaluating expanding Signal Hill against the Park City Interconnect. So in phase one of this project, we've got our focus is on resiliency and redundancy of the plant. As many of you know, the plant was designed previously, and we're coming in with some fresh eyes. We're looking at the plant in terms of what we would recommend from an engineering standpoint on reliability and redundancy. Most of it boils down to having, you know, N+1. So that philosophy of N+1, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, is having N number of pumps or pieces of equipment to meet your immediate needs and always having one in standby so that you can reliably meet your demand and not running into any issues where you're having to call up people and tell them you're not going to give them the water that they were hoping to get. In phase one, like I said, we're focusing mostly on reliability and redundancy. There is going to be a slight increase in the firm capacity of the plant during this phase, but really what we're focusing on is improving the water quality, process performance, and then reliability. So these are the main scope items that would be included in phase one. And I'll start at the top here. So the pretreatment modifications, currently you guys have bubble diffusers, which is not quite a standard practice for good flocculation. So we'd be retrofitting mechanical mixers in there, get a little bit better performance in the pretreatment unit process. but also help some downstream processes and reduce the load on the membranes, which are really the workhorse of the entire plant. We would be adding an additional MF or microfiltration rack to the plant, which would give us a little bit more reliability and redundancy on that unit process. And then GAC is going to be a workhorse for us on TOC removal, which is a precursor for disinfection byproducts, which is a key water quality concern for the district. So we're going to add two more GAC vessels in this phase to give us some more flexibility when we're replacing GAC. We are proposing to add a new chemical facility, which would have the appropriate amount of safety, secondary containment, and all of the code requirements for storage of chemicals on site. We would like to add a backwash EQ basin, which would give us a lot more operational flexibility when we're backwashing the GAC vessels, which are, again, going to become critical to the district meeting their water quality goals out of Signal Hill. There is currently residuals handling at the plant, which I'm sure many of you are aware, but that residuals handling is currently in the area that has been allotted to the expansion of the MF. So coming up with a holistic solution that would allow us to still get adequate residuals handling on site and also take up that space that is currently being used for the belt filter press. We would like to put some new infrastructure that would allow us to discharge a smaller amount of solids off-site to hopefully Snyderville Basin. We're in the process of working with them on a discharge permit that would allow us to discharge the residuals generated at the plant to them. So this is the key scope for phase one. That small bump in the capacity gets you out to 2032 thereabouts, that extra 0.6 NGD that we're getting. But then come 2032 and in the years leading up to that, you're also going to be needing to plan for the next. So what would all of that infrastructure that we talked about look like at the plant? A lot of it's going to be inside the building here, so the MF expansion would go here, the pretreatment modifications here, residuals handling and backwash on the opposite side, kind of away from the street view. You would like to put the chemicals on this side because we'd have better access through the site for chemical deliveries. It'd be safer and it would avoid having any ride along the pond, which would be a major issue if it fell into the pond. GAC expansion, we would bring out the back. And then as part of this overall phase one, we're master planning some space for future treatment to have future flexibility to meet changing water quality and regulations. So that might be an improved pretreatment system or adding an advanced oxygen like ozone. So this is the initial preliminary costs associated with phase one of the project, very preliminary budgetary planning numbers that we developed based on the scope that we just talked about. At the bottom is the capital cost. It does include engineering services during construction, commissioning, all that stuff, including non-construction costs. But right in the $25 million range, again, we think it's conservative. We are working to refine the cost currently to make sure that we're not being overly conservative. Nobody in the engineering world wants to be the engineer that told you it was $5 million. It's really $10 million. So a lot of cost estimates are very conservative at this point due to the recent market volatility. This is a good layout of the plant, kind of showing that inside the building, a lot of the area is spoken for. This is where the belt filter press currently is, and we need that space for the two additional MF racks that we'll need to meet the build-out flow. There's no additional room to put GAC, as you can see, so that's why we're coming out the back here. You got some solids handling that are currently in retrofitted basins that were previously, when the plant was designed, allotted for a second train of pretreatment. So we're looking to reclaim that for pretreatment, so you got two full trains through the far end of the plant where currently you have just the one, and if there's an issue with that pretreatment train, it's going to impact your ability to deliver water. And if I miss anything,
perfect.
So that was phase one. Now we're looking at phase 2A, which would be the additional expansion of Signal Hill to 5.4 MGD. So you'll notice that the scope is actually quite a bit smaller because we've done a lot of investment in the first phase on meeting the reliability and resiliency concerns. So really what we're doing is we're adding one more MF skid and then two additional GAC vessels. So those small, relatively small scope items give you two additional MGD of production capacity.
Is that phase two?
That would be phase two, yeah. And so this, we wanted to kind of put this up again so you guys could evaluate what phasing would do and what that would look like in terms of your construction projects and how that would all come together. So first, let's look at the source supply. So that's our bump from phase one. We get that 0.8 or 0.6 MGD bump, and then we get the 2 MGD bump here. And that, if we follow the current projections, will take us out to about the 2053 range on your projected peak day demand, which is very good. The phasing of this would be, you know, over the next 4 years, if ultimately this phase one gets approved, we would be in design and construction, and then the phase one would come online in 2027. But then within 1 or 2 years, you're right back to design on phase two. And so realistically, if you implemented the phased approach, you would be in either design or construction for the majority of the next 10 years at Signal Hill. Not to say that can't be done, it's just there are some, you know, concerns and some drawbacks of that approach, I guess, with having a contractor on site for the majority of the next 10 years.
While continuing to operate the treatment plant.
Exactly, yeah. And having a contractor mob and demob twice, and there would be some efficiency gain if it was all done at one shop, but obviously, got to make sure we've got the money to do it.
Partially what? Phase one is 4 years.
Phase one is definitely more complex in terms of what needs to be designed and then ultimately constructed. Phase two, when we were looking at the actual project timeline, like we wouldn't, in phase one, we would do maybe a more traditional 30, 60, 90, 100% of design phase. In phase two, if we're really only adding an additional MF skid that we already know the manufacturer, we already know where it's going to go, and hopefully we've done some master planning to make the plumbing up easier. We don't need a 30, 60, 90 design period. So that phase two, due to its simplicity, would definitely be shorter.
And then on the phase one side, like you could probably do that work a lot quicker, but because the plant's operational, you have to stagger it.
Exactly, yeah. Some of it's going to be relatively quick. Like if, you know, for example, on the MF, a lot of that time is spent just procuring. But building wise, there's going to be a decent amount of time spent on the chemical facility and the residuals. But yeah, good point. So this, again, like we've blacked out all the stuff that would be done in phase one and then just highlighted in red what we're doing in phase two. So this is the additional MF rack where the belt filter press is currently, and then these are the two additional GAC vessels that we would add in phase two. So this is the cost in April 2023 dollars of the phase two expansion of Signal Hill. So phase one was about $25 million. Phase two, due to its simplicity, is $11 million. So you're getting a lot more capacity for lower amount of investment in phase two. This is what the total project cost would be. $25 million in phase one, $11 million in phase two, for a total of $37 million presented in April 2023 dollars. So as Sam mentioned, we were comparing the expansion of Signal Hill against the interconnect with Park City. So when we look at this analysis, the assumption that's baked in here is that we've already done the phase one resiliency and redundancy project at Signal Hill.
I have a quick question.
Yep.
So the resiliency and redundancy project, that's not really growing the capacity like we would be. So as far as the impact on us, that project would mostly be not impact eligible.
So I'd have to defer to Sam on that one.
Okay. Yeah, we have to work it out. But yeah, I'd say the entire project would not be impact eligible.
So the full $25 million would be spread over our current customers. It would not be impact eligible.
Seems like it should be.
Yeah, part of it certainly would.
Because we're not.
But it's certainly 11 and a half,
giving us an extra $2 million per day.
Well, that's the 11 million. But the 25 million, that's resiliency and redundancy. I'm just, what portion of that is attributable to new growth? Or what portion of that is just to serve our current customers because of that resiliency and redundancy factor that goes, right? Like what we can include in the.
It's not just bringing the demand line up on the curve.
Right.
The
yeah.
I mean,
the 0.6 you're bringing up would be eligible. Right?
I think that could be justifiable. Yeah. But yeah,
is it 0.6 or 0.8?
Sorry, 2.6 to 3.4. 0.8.
Oh, 0.8, sorry.
But yeah, that's kind of where all this is going, right? It's selecting this project, getting the master plan, then direct the impact fee facility plan and build an impact fee around. So whatever is selected ends up in the master plan is going to drive the impact fee. And how those percentages work out, when they're going to be absorbed, etc., that's still working out here.
So when we're looking at kind of the financials of the Park City Interconnect scenario, there is an initial capital investment required to get the capacity from the interconnect. And we've got initial assumptions that we would be responsible for one third of about 5.6 million. So 1.8 million is roughly what we're assuming for the capital cost of the interconnect. And then really what's going to drive kind of the life cycle cost of this is the fees that Park City charges you for the interconnect. So initial discussions with Park City have shown that they're going to likely target 62% of the current Park City wholesale rate, which equates right now in 2023 to about almost $6 per gallon, or $6 per 1,000 gallons, excuse me. And then they've also tacked on a 4% year-over-year increase to that wholesale rate that they're charging him. So just for reference, if we're looking at using 550 GPM because the interconnect is roughly 1100 GPM capacity peak. If we were using 550 GPM throughout the year in 2023, that would be $1.7 million. And in 2048, that would be $4.6 million in water fees.
Just as an example.
Just as an example. That's not saying that's what we're projecting you're going to use, but just for reference as we move through this.
You need to put that into the life cycle cost.
And that would be treated water over that period.
Yeah, we're all, this entire discussion just about treated.
So we've sent our raw water to Park City through the infrastructure that we currently have. That's why it's a lower cost compared to what the Shell is selling water.
I'm just saying that at least we wouldn't have, like, that water coming back wouldn't have to be treated or be, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
$6 a 1,000 gallons.
A lot.
Yeah, it's not inexpensive.
And that would be all impacts eligible because the water that we're doing there, that would only be for new customers, if you will, right? Then if you came on, so that to me would be able to put an impact.
I would say yes.
I would say so.
You need to update your impact.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing with this.
But that's like an ongoing rate. That's not, you know, the $6 per 1,000 gallons. Are you saying that's impact fee eligible? Or
the 1.8?
Yeah, 1.8.
Yeah, the capital cost.
What was the annual cost of that 550 gallons a minute?
We actually have a more...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we have some better numbers that are more representative of reality. So when we're plugging in this projection and we're looking out to 2050 or 2060, this is what it would look like. So you've got your phase one reliability and redundancy project for Signal Hill gives you that initial bump, and then you start potentially using your interconnect with Park City in the 2033 range. And because you've got a lot of flexibility on, well, some flexibility on how much you ask them for, we can fit the usage from Park City to your peak day demand roughly. There are some nuances to that. I think you can peak it by two. So if you request 200 GPM on average, you can go up to 400 on a single day. So there are some operational limitations associated with the interconnect, but you're using what you need to get out to the 2040 range. But the caveat that Sam's going to touch on here is There are some basin-wide restrictions associated with going through Park City for that water.
Yeah, just briefly. We've been talking with Summit Water about their build-out projections and things of that nature and how much water they plan on purchasing long-term for Park City. And we have good data on the next 5 years on what they're contractually obligated to take through the regionalization agreement. And then the next 5 years is projection and the build-out number. So if you take our latest projection numbers from Bowling and Collins along with Summit Water's projections, under this scenario, the basin would lose that surplus Queens Junction water at 2040, which is a little earlier than what we're showing in projection. So that's something that's, in my mind, outside of our control. We can't really control what Summit Water is going to do. But if there is a large importation project that's triggered as a result of a basin shortage, then all this stuff just kind of gets blown up. A large importation project would be a much larger project, an order of magnitude or two larger than anything we're talking about here. So we're not going to go on an analysis of that, but I just want to point it out that there's limited surplus water available for Park City, and there's more than one interested party, essentially. Yeah.
And so the Park City interconnect utilization, like, would we have to have a contract where we're taking it in perpetuity out to 2065 or?
So we are trying to work through that. And the goal is not to get to a perpetual contract.
Yeah.
Because if we upgrade the treatment plant, still have to pay Park City, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
We'd rather buy time through Park City, upgrade our treatment plant, control our own destiny, and potentially have water that we could sell.
Yeah.
Be the goal.
So now that we've kind of walked through the two main alternatives that we're looking at to get and meet source demand or meet demand with resource development beyond 2033, we did a life cycle cost comparison. We also went through a multi-objective decision analysis process with Andy, Sam, and the staff. So we're going to walk through that here. This is kind of a high-level summary of that. There was a lot more coordination. There was a selection of non-cost criteria. There was ranking of that criteria and then scoring. A very collaborative approach to analyzing these two alternatives without cost in mind initially. So when you break down the Park City interconnect, the main pro is that there's a smaller initial capital cost investment than expanding the Signal Hill. So it's at $1.8 million versus that $11 million. Then there is less need to do additional work at Signal Hill. So you're not going to impact the site. The plant staff can kind of operate and be left alone without a contractor getting in their way. The pro of the expansion is that you control your own operations and water quality. You got future operational flexibility because you've got more water available than your demand is requiring for majority of the next 10 to 20 years. And then, like Andy just mentioned, you might have the ability to put water on the table and sell water from Signal Hill and have another revenue source. The cons are with the Park City Interconnect that you have less control of your operations and water quality. We know that it's going to be good water coming out of Quinn, but we don't have as much control over some of the nuances related to disinfection byproducts, pH, corrosion control, those things. And then you're ultimately relying on Park City between 2033 and 2045, roughly, to meet your peak demand. And like we just talked about with Sam, that it might limit your ability to expand Signal Hill without the importation project, which could be orders of more capital costs than the investment in Signal Hill.
Is that because we're giving our raw water to Park City to treat? Or why couldn't we? I don't understand why we couldn't expand Signal Hill.
Have a three-tier approach, I guess. Is that the question?
Yeah.
So do phase one, buy water from Park City, and then do an expansion, but delay the expansion. We did not evaluate that, but I don't think it'd be as competitive enough.
Wait, is that your question, or I had a different question?
Why couldn't we expand Signal Hill in the future without importation?
That, yeah, the that way it's written. I have the same question.
You can. Sorry. Okay, maybe it's written in a little bit confusingly, but the without it triggering the importation, I think what we're assuming with the Park City analysis is that if we put that water on the table with Park City, the assumption is that it might be in perpetuity. And so if we then want to expand Signal Hill, that water is already accounted for, that 5.4 MGD of the Lost Canyon. And if we then decide we need more capacity at Signal Hill, where's that water coming from?
Gotcha. Jason? That's helpful. Yeah, to Andy's point, Andy's been pressing hard on the regionalization group to come up with a solution that would negate that con, essentially, and make a solution where we could do something.
The way I read the master agreement, it says if we have our own water, raw water, treated, and we're not selling it, it's outside of the master agreement. If we were sending it to Park City to sell it to some of water, I think that is a perpetual obligation. But that's my interpretation.
That makes sense, so that's fair. Because the plan would be to up the pipeline size from Lost Canyon, send that water to Park City, have them treat it.
So all of these assume the current no big project on the Lost Canyon side.
Okay.
So even, even expanding to 5.4 MGD at Lost Canyon can be done with Mon Regional's current allocation in that Lost Canyon.
And there is potential on the Highway 40 system. If you add a booster pump, you could actually flow more than the 1,100 or 1,095, whatever is flowing now. Let's see. Up to section 27.
So the cons on the expansion are the larger capital cost investment initially, and then you're going to have, you know, contractors messing around with your operators while they're trying to operate your key water treatment plant. So that's a high-level distillation of the MODA process that we all went through as part of this project. This is the ultimate result of that. So when we took all of these non-cost criteria, then assigned the weight, then assigned the score, we came up with the overall MODA score of 69.8 for the Park City Interconnect and 79.2 for the expansion. So based on non-cost criteria and the, you know, weight that we put on all of these, expanding Signal Hill meets more of our needs, not the cost perspective. So this is the net present value comparison between the Park City Interconnect and the expansion of Signal Hill. So we've got the initial phase one investment in Signal Hill included in both of them. We've got the expansion of Signal Hill included in the in this alternative, obviously, and then the initial capital cost for the interconnect. And then our operational cost for Signal Hill associated with that. So because that graph that we're looking at is just a peak, the majority of the year, the actual usage of Signal Hill isn't that different between this scenario and 5.4. So the operational costs on an annual basis, which are not all inclusive, are actually fairly close because there's a lot of sunk costs just for maintenance, staffing that you need either way, whether you're operating the plant at 5.4 MGD or 3.4 MGD. We did an annual average flow of 399 for the 25-year life cycle for the interconnect. And that in the first year comes out to 2.4 million in interconnect fees from Park City. When you bake all that together, the net present value for the interconnect is about 42 million. And then just shy of that for the Signal Hill expansion is 41.7. So they're essentially equal when we look at the life cycle cost.
And is there one of these that, I guess, would the interconnect benefit any of the other players involved, Sun Water, Park City, et cetera?
The interconnect allows the Highway 40 system to be freed up. Right now, Sun Water is dominating the use on that. So the only way that we could receive water back from Park City is to get Sun Water off that Highway 40 system and push them down 224. If that makes sense.
Does it
little foreshadowing for later.
I guess what I'm asking is, does Park City have any skin in the game? Are they interested in having the interconnect done and monetize that in any way?
Well, certainly Park City, if the interconnect happens on 224, they can sell more water. And then they can also monetize treating our water and sending it back. So it's a win-win for Park City.
Right. Is there any way to get them to recognize that in a more beneficial way to us?
So they would be paying a third of the cost of the interconnect, okay, as opposed to 50-50.
Right.
But
that's already baked into these numbers.
Yes, but what it also does is it also delays a future large expansion project by utilizing the water that's currently in the basin, as opposed to triggering a large importation project, which would be probably three times this cost.
Question on that. But timing wise, with the Park City Interconnect, when do we trigger the regionalization big project? That's the 2040 number?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And that's very back of the napkin, again, taking two other agencies at their word with their planning numbers, But when you assume just a linear progression of demands that's on the water, it comes out to 2040.
Or it's 2053.
I think.
For Signal Hill.
If Mountain Regional fully allocates the Lost Canyon system, I think it's possible that we can hit our build out without relying on anybody else to do so.
So then we wouldn't use the interconnect in perpetuity.
No, I think if Signal was expanded to meet the capacity of Lost Canyon, the existing capacity of Lost Canyon, I think it's possible we could hit our build out number without any wholesale water purchase from Park City.
Okay. So on the MODA scores, was there the ease of operations, if we had the Park City interconnect, is there value there in doing the phase one expansion to where the plant could be down? And is that in there anywhere? Is that even valid?
But taking Signal Hill offline?
Yeah, and do the interconnect first, and then you can use that while on the plant and not trying to run a plant.
That interconnect would be limited to the treatment capacity at Quinns. So it depends on what they're sending. The capacity at Quinns is 3,100?
I think in GPM, I think it's 3,500 GPM is Quinns capacity.
So as long as we're not competing.
What's that?
5 MG.
Yeah, it's not a little bit. Yeah.
There's that limitation that, I mean, depending, if it's a wintertime project, that's one thing, but no way that we can shut down in warm weather.
No, that's interesting. I haven't thought of that before, Mike. But one other thing I would say is the current Highway 40 system, the capacity of that system, so our ability to receive water from Park City, is much lower than the current capacity of Signal Hill. So we'd be taking a huge hit to the our source portfolio.
Taking the plant down and just trying to run on the interconnect. Okay.
Like over 1,000 GPM.
But we did give, I'm not sure which non-cost criteria it was, but we did give the interconnect some higher points because you got Signal Hill as a resource and you got another resource coming in. But there is some benefit there with something that's like, if you have a fire at Signal Hill, you can call out, Park City, you can get water through the interconnect. So that was accounted for in this analysis.
And that green line.
Yeah.
Green one's a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the differentiator on the wildfire resiliency?
Yellow one.
Yeah.
We're putting in, we selected through another discussion that we had. We had an evaluation that we did with how we would try to approach wildfire in the basin. And the ultimately, the technology that we selected for meeting TOC, which would have a big impact from the wildfires, was we were going to do GAC replacement. And GAC replacement is a robust tool for dealing with like smoky odors in the water and the higher TOC. So because we were already planning to do the GAC replacement approach, it got a little bit better score on that. And then Quinns also doesn't have pretreatment, which Signal Hill does. So when Quinns experiences a high turbidity slug from, you know, spring runoff or a fire, they have to shut down sometimes. So even though it's like a marginal difference, you know, our pretreatment's not to the most robust pretreatment that I've seen out there, obviously, but it is slightly better than Quinns in terms of wildfire resiliency.
Sparks seem to have a pretreatment step.
No, there's been talk about regionally doing a pretreatment facility, but no, they, I don't think they have the square footage allotted on their site to do a full pretreatment. But it was designed as a
truck pond and all that stuff over there.
What's that?
Regionally? Yeah. Sorry, what do you mean by regionally?
There's just been preliminary discussions about it.
Regionally in their system?
Like,
no, you know, no,
we were putting up pretreatment.
In an emergency kind of wildfire situation.
Yep.
Instead of building something that may or may not happen, you could have something ready to go that they said is pretty deliverable relatively quickly to be able to treat it like a package. So you didn't have to build a huge asset.
Which is a great idea. Part of the city came up with that one. And again, that would be located at Signal Hill to
let me follow up with the other questions. This would be dumb, but how much protection do we have in this system if a well-intentioned fire happens and it goes across or goes through the where you're developing this? I mean, what do we have a lake? Do we have a stream? Do we have other safety measures in place?
Well,
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I mean, that's kind of a nightmare scenario for the basin, really, is having if an upper fever watershed had a significant wildfire. Maybe the question is, could we continue to operate the plant if we had a true wildfire event in the upper fever basin? I would say currently in its current state, we probably could not.
Could not, okay. Next question would be, have we planned enough for the future as well? I'm so negative, but I'm trying to be positive now. What about expansion and capacity?
I think that's what we're looking at, putting things in the net present value and trying to, you know, think of the long term. So, and types.
We're trying to crystal ball it.
I know. I mean, I just want to make sure that we're doing the, and I know we are, but I want to make sure we're doing the best that we can do and think for the future. Not for the present, but, you know, 20 years out, 25 years out or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, 2065.
It kind of maxes out this site, though, that there's really not much more we're going to get out of that.
Do we need to think about doing something else after that from a planning standpoint?
That would be to meet Bill now, because you can kind of see the gap on the far right side of the page between the yellow column and green, which kind of represents those building numbers. I'm hoping it wouldn't be a significant project that we could meet build-out with fully utilizing the existing Waskin system.
Yeah, I mean, cost will probably go up, but what the hell? I mean,
but that curve, the demand curves. You know, from the Planning Commission's point of view, do we have a flat curve or the curve that keeps going up?
I want to think that not the president. I know I'm saying this a couple of times, But, I mean, it's great that we're doing this, but what about the future? I mean, we're going to expand. I mean, there's a lot of land left.
So this is based on our current annex area, the best we know it. But it doesn't mean that as the county continues to grow, our expansion may happen. And, you know, I don't know if there's much wiggle room in these numbers to back. It's all unknown. But we're trying to do our best with the information that we have today with some assumptions on some growth. And if it keeps raining this way, you know, last summer was a different story than today.
And by expansion, are you primarily talking about to the east?
Or to the south?
East or the south. Boundary. Okay.
Right, as promontory moves, we've had calls.
But we should have acquisition of assets when we do that.
Well,
it's not like we're going to zero. We do some of those.
It could be some native uncharted territory. Right? Going down Browns Canyon and that way.
There's resources there.
Need them to be financial.
You need to take them away from where they're at right now. Yeah.
That's about covered it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. This is the distillation of the MODIS score and the net present value. The most ideal position on this graph is to be up here, the lowest cost and the highest score. You can see that they're relatively similar on cost, but as we pointed out, Sigma Hill has a slightly better MODIS score. So the one thing that this doesn't factor in on the cost is just if the importation project gets triggered earlier and what that cost is.
Yeah, so we kind of already touched on next steps. Again, we're not asking for any sort of board approval tonight. We want to keep you guys in the loop as much as possible as we're scrambling to finish this master plan. If you want to take all the comments you may have, they don't have to be right now, too. If you have some later, please pass them along with Andy or myself. And, we'll continue progress on the.
Yeah, I'm starting to understand it better. So yeah. Thanks, you guys, because
that's a really good
piece. It's not just 0.8 MGD for 25 million. There's some things that needed to be done, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's a really good comment by you, Mike. And I think I wasn't able to paint that picture fully previously. But I think if you look at it like a comprehensive project, then the dollars per gallon number starts looking a lot more in line with other projects, I guess.
But it kind of feels like we got that plan together and going almost like the initial Spiro. And anyway, yeah, so thank you guys.
And that's a little while we got. Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing is there could be, ancillary costs to this as well, because you take on projects of this magnitude. Sam's workload, what happens there, maybe bringing on more staff, manage other projects, this project. So there are other things that we're going to have to consider as we move forward and get closer to these times.
One more. Yeah, these are kind of just, again, the scratch projections rather than playing around with on a basin level with some of the water data. I can just run through these really quick. So in this one, the columns just show projected Summit water demands. So there's only one agency here. And then the red line is Quinn's capacity. So at their build-out number, which is about 30, a little bit over 3,100 GPM, they can get satisfied by the surplus capacity at Quinn's.
Yeah, that final date is 2041 where they flatline. No, I'm saying where it flatlines. Where their growth flatlines is 2041.
So that's the excess capacity in Quinn's is...
The red lines represented as Quinn's excess capacity, or the entirety of Quinn's capacity. I'm sorry. The surplus capacity currently in basin is Quinn's capacity. So now this kind of combines regional's projected demands from the work we did with Bowman Column with those same numbers from Summit Water. And this is under that phase
2B.
So this is the interconnect option. So when you add both our demands, When you add both the demands together, we obviously surpass that 3,500 GPM at some point. If you take our build-up numbers, as gospel, and they're the best planning numbers we have, I guess. And if you work back from that, then it's about 2040. It's the back of the napkin
important project.
So then we start planning for 2035, where we were basing it. They identify 5 years out that triggers that importation project under the master agreement.
So it does take us a while to really start using very much interconnect water.
But yeah, and if this assumes the phase one projects we buy that 0.8.
Okay, we didn't need. Okay.
And then the next one, we'll go down, Chris.
That's why I'm down one more than you.
Oh, is this the last one?
Yep.
Okay, this one, to your point, Mike, this is saying we're doing nothing for source development. When are we running out of water in the basin?
And it's 2036 is when we cross over.
We're saying 2031.
Wasn't there also a picture of the plant that had a section in there to get water from SB Weird? I thought there was one of those.
Do you use reclaimed water, you mean?
Yeah.
But the state wasn't allowing that.
That's going away at the end of this year.
Yeah.
Senator House Bill.
It's on.
No, I don't understand either.
Anyways.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, should we be going to executive
session? Question in the executive session, though. Can board members ask to go into executive session?
Sure.
Okay. Can I make a request?
Sure.
Personnel.
I mean, that's the chair, purview of the chair.
Oh.
Quick discussion.
Yes. So.
Who would you like here and not here?
You and the board.
Okay.
Please.
You want a motion to move into executive
session? Yes. Motion to move into executive session to discuss personnel.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Hey.
Thank you for recording again.
Okay. We're on with the consent agenda. Does anyone have any questions on the meeting minutes?
Did you guys motion to move out?
We did. We motioned to move out.
Joel and Corey.
So does anyone have any questions on the minutes being checked register?
The check register.
Go. All right. Okay, so there was one Ford F-150 listed. Can you remind us, where we are on all the vehicles that are outstanding that we've approved?
We are all caught up now. We bought 3 new trucks this year.
Okay.
We had one that rolled over from last year that was delayed in getting received.
Yep.
We bought the Can-Am, a trailer. There's no more expenditures coming out of the capital budget, really.
And just the one F-150 was on this month?
Yeah, the other two were the previous month.
But we did all 3 light bars at once?
Yeah.
Okay. For the prior. Okay. Thank you. And then, I really appreciate the things in the annual, on the Caterpillar release.
Oh.
That really helps. But then speaking of the Caterpillar release, was it backed out and then brought back in?
There was the check, the printer jammed. Okay. And the only way, it's a good internal control that it basically voids all those numbers automatically and you have to reprint them all.
Okay.
So you can't do weird things with voided checks.
Call the check from the B next to it.
That had the amount out and then the zero. Those were all voided. Yeah.
All voids.
Okay.
Basically, that means it was ACH'd out. It wasn't a signed check. If it says M or M by it.
And then there was one drug screening this month, but it was a random. Can you remind us how the random works?
There's a list that kind of, is it DOT that picks from the list? Lisa, I'm not sure how the random, how do they pick them?
So depending on the status of the employee, if they have a CDL, or they're just a safety fence at imposition based on their job description. They're put in pools, and then those pools are randomly selected. We use Workforce QA to do all of our third-party testing, and they generate the random list, and then they get sent to me, and then I send to the employees who have been selected. So sometimes the billing will be a little bit off, so we might not always get all three at one time, depending on if it was DOT or a safety sensitive. Sometimes, because the testing is different.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm making.
But it sounds like it's kind of preloaded.
Oh, yeah. They do the selections. Yeah. I don't. Yeah, so I don't do it. Yeah, they do the selections.
Okay. And I think you walked us through that before.
That's okay.
Yeah, no,
yeah, no, it's
fine. And then last one I had in the checker shirt, the Scott Johnson septic system replacement. What was that?
That was down at Lost Canyon. It was the toilets were backing up because there really wasn't a separate tank. It was just a leach line out.
Oh.
And they found that out. So kind of emergency to get a septic tank installed down there.
And it was our cost because
it's our
cabin.
This is the cabin. Yeah. The office down there.
The office down there.
At Lost Canyon.
What's the Scott Johnson?
That's his name.
That's the guy who installed it.
Oh, sorry. Got it. Okay. Understood.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, it wasn't another sit away thing.
Not sorry.
Yeah. I had two questions. There was an irrigation upgrade that was just in a bucket called system improvements for $18,000.
It was for loss for the treatment plant. They had a compressor. Is that it says irrigation upgrade?
Yeah, it was for not $18,000. $48,141.
What page is that one on? Do you know? Or who it's to? I think it's the one that we were talking about today.
Is the SKM?
I don't know. I don't have a copy of the check register. But I thought it was on maybe the third or fourth page. Is it the first time I made it?
Out of 22 pages.
Yeah. That's the truck. That's the compressor that was 18.
35.
That's power for 48, but that was power. So that irrigation upgrade. Ignition upgrade.
Yeah, that was the SCADA upgrade, the final billing for the stuff that we've been working on since the beginning of the year. Finally, they invoiced us for it. And among some other ignition things that happen, SCADA related things.
Cool. It's ignition.
That's the software that does all of our SCADA historizing and allows for the remote control stuff.
Yeah.
And then did we do a PO on the trailer? The 17,000?
Yeah, but it's under 20. So oh, okay. You guys don't.
That's all I had.
Okay.
And then everyone gets Steve's response for the collections last month on the vendor that we didn't know.
Yep.
Yes.
So in the timely manner right after.
Okay. And section 6 is delinquent fees and charges.
I need a motion on the consent agenda.
Oh, yeah. Do we need to approve the
agenda? Motion to approve the consent agenda as discussed.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
It's
unanimous. Hey, Anna, I think we're on to you.
This is the updated list as of today, newer than what you guys had in the packet. So
in the packet, I think it was 4 pages. Jackie, Kimberly, and I have been calling and emailing most of the people on there to see if we can get it down even further. We're down to like 13.
Yep.
Yeah.
And only 17 grand.
So we do this annually. Everyone who's delinquent. At least 3 months, if not more, down there. It's the large ones, like that top one, Rick Saunders. His is due to a week, and it's actually been off since October. It's water.
But he hasn't agreed. Oh, so we turned his water off.
His water's been off.
Wow. I've had several conversations with him.
Holy cow.
Zach Olson, his is the other large one. His is due to his excessive watering last year during the drought rates. So we've reached out to him to ask him if he just wants to up his payment plan because he's on one. It's just it's not going down very far. Other than that, we've reached out to most people.
If someone's on a payment plan, still do a lien?
I try not to. Like if they've reached back out, there was a couple that were on payment plans. And if they are on an auto pay, then I just make sure that they're going to stay on the auto pay. Ask them kind of like what their watering plans are because it'll just make it even longer.
Right? Yep.
Especially like Zach. So.
And that's why we're waiting Zach.
Yeah. And he hasn't reached out. We've left him emails and voicemails.
So he's not a plan, but he's not going to catch up. So
that's going to work. That's going to work.
Makes sense. Cool.
And we might get more off by the time we get on the schedule with the county. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Great work, Anna. So I know it's going to be fun calling people up and asking for money. That's really good.
I actually don't mind collections.
Steve, what do you have for us?
So results through, oh, thank you. Through May, we are $859,000 better than budget at this point, $512 better on the revenue side, and $347 below on the expense side. The main cause of revenue overage is the interest earnings, like we've talked about before, that we're at almost $450,000 already this year, and we'd only budget our $153,000. Just making a lot in the PTIF account, which we talked about earlier. An interesting thing on the retail water sales, heading into May, we were $181,000 better than budget. Since May was wet and we kind of knew it would be slow, we gave some ground back, so now we're only $115,000 better there. Promontory were under budget because they really didn't turn on much water till the very end of May. And then the other revenue shows the interest earnings.
Do we need to do a motion? We need to do a motion for.
Oh, sorry.
For the delinquent.
Yep.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Sure. Motion for consideration of recommendation of approval of the certified tax lien for delinquent fees and charges as discussed to the county council.
Do we have a second? Okay. All in favor?
Aye. Sorry, Steve.
No, that's great. a nice thing that did happen during May is we popped ahead on impact fees for a little bit. We're actually above budget. As you recall, we brought the budget way down, but we actually are above it just slightly at this point in time. So that's good news. We're having expense savings still kind of from almost all departments, mainly salary and wages, and distribution of public services. And our repairs actually haven't been as expensive as usual through just in distribution or at Lost Canyon. Our cash went up, $639,000, or at least our cash that we can actively do things with. That was partially because we got our first quarter payment from Weber Basin for the water we wheeled to Summit Water for $311. Plus, we reimbursed ourselves from the impact fee fund for the interconnect. So basically, it takes a restricted cash, puts it into cash we can use on whatever we want.
For the interconnect we were talking about with Will and Jake?
No, this was past.
Okay.
Reimbursing ourselves for the regionalization interconnects that have already happened.
Because we paid it out of the general fund.
We paid them out of the general fund, and then we just reimbursed ourselves.
And it would be the last one that Summit Water put in, correct? Yeah, it's the last
2 years ago.
Yeah, okay. That we finally got the last invoice.
Yeah, for. Last year, at the end of last year.
Oh, they put it in 2 years ago. They finally billed us.
Oh, they finally billed us. Okay.
Do you think that those numbers that you mentioned, do you think what you've got going on in the future, I mean, is it going to get worse or is it going to get better?
Well, I think we're going to go back to kind of pre-COVID on growth numbers because, interestingly enough, if you look at 19 and 20, we had 52 and 42 people come in and pay a fee that I want to become a customer. This year, we're at 45. So we're right back in kind of the historical averages, whereas these last 2 years, we're very high on customer growth. So I think we're going back to more our historical averages on growth. An interesting part on usage and kind of jolt to what I might see happening in June. In May,
we were 23% below the four-year average in usage. So it took, that's where the hit revenue came from. And we kind of knew that. We've been talking about that before. Like, it's a good thing we're running above budget because we're going to give some back. June, now I'm getting a little more anxious because we're halfway through. And if anybody's paying attention, they don't need to be watering outside. So we'll see how that plays out. This is probably best showed by this graph, which you guys are kind of familiar with now. So the blue line is this year. And usually we always get that little bump in May. This year it bumped, but not nearly as much. So basically the 22% or 23% drop in usage wasn't our rate increased and our growth couldn't even get us back to where we have historically been. So when usage drops like that, it really does a number. June is usually our first month of good usage. We're not going to get it. So we're going to come in under, I'm almost pretty sure, here somewhere. I think we'll still be fine. We're running above, but we're running better than budget, but it'll, we'll watch that number, see if we start getting usage. And real quickly, I know it's a long night. Every category for May budget, which you would expect, was under budget except churches and Park City Wheeling, because Park City still seems to be taking a lot of water to run through Quinn's Junction. But you can see irrigation basically was way off, residential, commercial, everything was under budget because of the lack of usage.
That golf number could change with the watering the short course.
Yeah. See, I'd kind of planned on they would start watering the short course early, but they didn't have to, kind of thing to get it. So that's it through May. So June will be the midpoint in the year. So we'll do a little bigger report, include more about the capital stuff, and then we'll be right into budget season.
Why are churches not following the trend?
I think they just had
holy water.
Yeah.
No, the one by my house, they've been sprinkling.
Yeah, so maybe that was it. There's only like two or three of them.
One just had the blue roof?
Yes.
And because the division of drinking has emailed us that they're excessive watering.
They are.
Yeah.
Is that St. Luke's?
I tried to reach out to them, but they weren't. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
All right. Any other questions? Is that okay? Tonight?
You always do a great summary, Steve.
Thank you. All right. I think I'm done for a little bit. I'll even close that for you. First look. Boom.
This is oh, no. We still have Andy Garland.
Yeah, sorry to be boring there. In your packet, I did include the Bowen Collins engineering report on the Highway 40 system. And also our 2023 water concurrency approval letter. Sam is instrumental in both of those. Based on the discussion we just had with Jacobs and the Bowen Collins, is just the details of that new interconnect. Now, I may steal Lisa's thunder, but we have had six people on the landscape turf removal, and we've met with two of them. So that's been good.
We had $3 a square foot there. Yeah.
Can I ask about the water concurrency? So it said that we were down to 0.64 gallons per minute. What was it before?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, 0.72.
Wow, that's significant.
Yeah, it's the first time since I've been in the district that the concurrency altered, made a reduction. They did so across the biggest.
Wow. That's 0.64 gallons per minute for ERU.
ERC? And is their definition of ERC?
Well, we provide them under ERC.
Incredible. I had a question there about how does that fit with the state division of drinking water reg? And it used to be 400, right?
Yeah. So the state of Utah for indoor water use used to require 800 gallons per minute, peak day, I believe, and 400 gallons of storage. And they have since set a system-specific number for each public water system over 3,300 people, including us. So now we have a system-specific number that's based on our our real data, our reporting.
Because they're realizing all systems aren't created equal.
Yeah, it was a statute. It was a development-backed statute at the state government level.
St. George, Park City, Mountain Regional, we're all just a little different. So we shouldn't all have the same exact standard.
Yeah. That's to your question. Like, concurrency and going to state regulates, there are a lot of different flavors on the same.
It's really low.
What's your concern on that?
How does it change? Because I'd always thought that the 800 peak day, 400 average day, this is an average day, 0.64.
Yeah.
And it's based on real data over the last, is it 4 years?
6 years. 4 years is what the report said. I thought it was a 6-year average. That's what the memo said.
Then it says.
Yeah, the numbers significantly dropped the last 3-ish. But yeah, they have numbers going back when the concurrency ordinance was started.
Well, with that low number, it makes it look like we can serve a lot more as long as it stays that low.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the product that's coming online behind us, and then, you know, the exceptions, the colony and other areas. But now irrigation or landscaping going forward should be smaller. So that is the way it's trending, and we hope it trends and continues to trend that way and not go the other way.
Generally, concurrency would look fairly good. Summit water was really hitting against ceiling to the point where it was concerning. This adjustment helped them a lot.
They didn't have to follow the 400 gallons each day.
Well, again, the DDW numbers don't really get involved with the data. It helped them on paper look better than current advisor.
Reminder, what was the number before?
0.72 to 0.64. I don't know if you remember the units, whether it's on average day or peak day. For the past kind of arbitrary. Usage per connection, equivalent residential connection, was lowered basin wide through the concurrency program.
Big deal.
Yeah, that is a big deal.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Okay. Anything else, Andy?
No, thank you.
Okay. Dave Thomas, do you have anything for us?
Nope.
Okay.
That's always so good.
I know. Does anyone have questions on the department updates? Who had the best pictures?
Oh, I think
I had more
pictures were the best. The new summit park paint. That looks like a really nice neighborhood to live in. Is this where we would also ask about the last slide on schedule? We do this at the same time. So the board retreat looks like it's on the 1st September now. Is there more planning on that or more insight?
It needs to be planned.
Okay. I was going to ask if there's anything more.
No, it is something that we need to commit to. And we'll meet. I'll chat with Lisa next week and pin down a specific date that we're kicking it down the road.
And you'll send out a memo if you're reminding us.
Yes.
Thank you. And I did have one other question for Brian. That the power outage in Summit Park, that created or caused the one main break?
Is that what you're asking there?
How does that work? The power pump.
That was on our pump line.
Yes.
So I think those guys that were doing those wildfire mitigation, they hit the power line. They were pumping it, deserving to slam the spot.
Yeah. Except for Kilby. So Kilby was pumping into a closed system.
Yeah.
Because no tank one right now.
Yeah.
We didn't blow it up. Where, and where to blow up?
Yeah. Roger Dixon, want to add to that?
We're going to hold off this stage and put it on the band-aid content.
Came right out to the circus, or?
Yeah, I was going for the
We didn't completely empty the tank, though. They got it in time, so.
Good question. Is some of our game getting any better?
Absolutely. Every day.
Every patch.
Yes. Next week, the new water line will start. And it, every day, I mean, that tank's going every day, y'all.
What about other areas that are...
We've had a couple of issues in Glen Wild.
Yes.
We've had a couple issues in Promontory. Some were self-inflicted.
Really?
Yes. There, you know, we had a contract to hit a water line in Promontory. We had a problem over in Silver Spring. So there are other things that happen that aren't necessarily age-related. It's just the nature of the business. Okay. And we love Summit Park.
By the way, I'm going to leave on Summit Park.
What's that?
I was only kidding.
That's okay. We were going to go to the office there.
Probably wouldn't have been such rock.
So, eating on all the roads would be ideal.
Especially,
yeah, the we need the podcast to come through. The only ones in the scheme.
Yeah.
Okay. Now on to the fun part, right? The consideration of approval to issue Ameresco a notice to proceed.
Yeah, so we had a big update this Monday. As you were aware, we had been working with Ameresco on the Blue Sky grants to try and get some funding to make this whole floating solar array at the treatment plant a go. I'm not sure if you've been privy to some of that stuff or okay. So the project, it looked like it got to the point where it really wasn't even going to fly. The only way that it was going to work was to do some sort of a power purchase agreement with Ameresco. They would take the full risk on the project. They would install it. We would just buy the power from them. That was kind of I was not feeling very positive at all about the whole Blue Sky thing. Turns out on Monday, get an email that we actually did get awarded $400,000, which is, you know, a magnitude greater than I thought we would get. It makes the project now feasible for us to do and have a 10-year payback window on it. So now having us own it and operate it moving forward is definitely a better feather in our cap. And talking with the people at Ameresco, they totally understand and they get it. You know, it's a win-win for them either way it goes, right? Either they own the asset or we own it, and we get to take the bigger kudos, if you will, by moving forward with it.
It's also, in addition to the Blue Sky grant, it's an ITC.
Yeah. So what that another piece of this one is that the ITC, which is the infrastructure tax credit. So the way the infrastructure tax credit works for us, since we're tax-free entities, we will actually get essentially a check at the end once it's all commissioned. And the Ameresco is 100% confident on a 30% credit based on the total project cost. They are also very optimistic that the next level, which is a 40%, is obtainable, and it's based on the amount of domestic product that we're using. They've reached out to their suppliers for the various products we're using for whether it's the electrical components, cabling, and so forth. There's enough percentage of domestic product that other entities have already moved forward with the assumption that they're getting the 40%. So they're sending it back to their accountants and to their legal to make sure that they think it's going to go that way. But at a minimum, they're assured we'll get 30%. Optimistically, we'll get 40%. So it makes a little bit of a swing at the end, but every little bit helps.
Are they going to recommend who should use?
They're already supplying. They've already submitted a their RFP had all their suppliers. Oh. Yep. Yep.
Design and construct.
Yep. So right now we're at a 30% level of drawing. It was enough to get through the net metering application with Rocky Mountain Power and all of their engineering to be able to say that we can connect that size solar array to the system without having to upgrade anything, and to get through the Blue Sky approval process.
What is the kW rating of the array?
The annual is, I want to say it's approximately 800.
Just a little under.
Yeah.
What hours or kW?
Kilowatt. 800. 800. Yeah, I can't remember how that was worded.
125 kW, 480 volts.
I'll have to get back to you with that one, Mike. I'll send you an email later.
No, I was just trying to scale it in with, an approval.
It's the whole project's under a megawatt, so and that's one of the thresholds too for the project. We come in just under a megawatt, so that's why I'm saying it's in the 850 range for kilowatts.
What's the total project cost?
So the total contract was awarded at $1.8 million. And we think that there'll actually be some savings because of the wattage of the panels is more is greater per panel. So they'll have less panels and less floats. So the total array size will drop.
So we're looking at $400,000 off of the $1.8. It's down to $1.4.
Yeah, so if you, yes, when Steve does his bit in the next piece, you'll see the dollar sides of all this. Yeah.
They're not going to have a budget, are they? Their budget?
Yeah, they have a not to exceed figure in the contract.
How much does this move the needle on our county goal for renewable energy?
So this finishes with what we're doing with the, the Twilla project. I can't think of the name of it. Yeah, buying the extra 3% we're going to pay starting next year for power as a premium for using the Twilla solar array. This was the last piece that we had excluded from that from our numbers, from our consumption numbers. This completes that.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is like a press release level.
Oh yeah.
Oh, this is going to get.
Yeah.
If you listen to this Green Earth this past week,
who missed the boat?
They were talking about floating solar arrays. And I can't remember who the expert, where they were from. And then there was an article in the Tribune a couple of weeks ago about floating solar arrays. And me and Lisa and Chris have just pushed this along.
Awesome.
Oh. I think Rocky Mountain, they want to do something.
Yeah.
There'll be some,
We'll get some
pretty much. As far as we know, this is the largest award they've done.
Yep, a single award for Blue Sky. Or pretty close to it, at any rate. It's one of the larger ones. From Blue Sky. Yeah, for a single project. So they had approximately $1 million for the entire year for two grant cycles. And so we got almost half of it.
So,
yeah. To say I'm stunned is an understatement. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Good job.
So the consideration today is to go ahead with the way the contract is written, that there's a second phase. Notice to proceed notice to proceed with milestone 2 and attachment D, which is for them to be able to finish the 100% drawings and to move forward with construction. So the one caveat to this is that we would like to have you also add to that with a future amendment to the contract. Currently, the contract gives them 375 days. Their adjusted timeline ends basically middle of August next year. They're being pessimistic with a start date of May 1st. It's quite possible they could start before that or even this fall with some of the early stuff. So what we're asking for is for an absolute date of end of August of 2024 for completion. So we'll do consideration for the part with the amendment to the contract for a later date, end of August 2024.
It binds us to $1.8 million
to them. Yep.
Yeah. And I'll show you where the money's coming from for that.
Do we have a motion?
One more question, real quick.
I know you got a 10-year payback period on this. Is there any short-term impact to rates, to water rates, that are it's going to have to be taken into consideration in the water recovery process here?
No, and you'll see that when you see Steve's funding slides with the budget amendment stuff. Yeah, our annual cost at the treatment plant is roughly $80,000. And that's how we came up with the 10-year payback window. So the 800 would be the 10 years. Mm-hmm. So.
The 800.
Do you want to talk about this So the first part's basically what Chris summarized, you know, about the two funding sources. So the estimated project cost is at $1.8 million. We've already currently budgeted $378,000 for it. We'll get $400,000 grant from Blue Sky, and then the investment tax credit is at least $530,000. So But it could be more.
Able to have any influence on that? Or we're just limited by
if we buy enough US. Yeah.
Yeah. And the IRS. I mean, that's who the final say is on it, right? They're the ones, the IRS is the one that determine whether it's the 30 or the 40.
Based on how many US materials.
Correct.
Yeah. 378,
we've already give discretion.
Tax.
I don't think it's necessarily like discretion. It's the way that the way that Amerisco is talking about is that their accountants are confident that they meet the criteria that is defined in the Infrastructure Act. And so therefore, because they feel that they fit it, I don't think it's a gray area with the IRS. I think they've decided that they're there.
AIS. Is that what that is? AIS.
The infrastructure.
It's called the Investment Tax Credit, ITC. I think it was part of the larger infrastructure bill.
Yeah,
that was approved. Okay. So this just shows, though, we'll get the 378 we've already approved that we've already budgeted for previous years, the 400,000, then the tax credit that minimum 530. So we're asking for another 500,000 just to make sure we hit that. Then if the 40%, we'd basically get another $176,700. So our investment would drop from 500,000. To $323,000 plus the $378 we've already committed. We're going to fund this out of the regionalization reserve. As you recall, that's the money from selling the wholesale water that was over $2 million. We used about $1 million. Get the office going. We're more done with the office. We'll take another $500,000 out of that to finish this project. So along those lines, it's no additional expense or draw to rates because it's coming out of reserves we already have. So this is just an updated the budget. This is what we'll present to the county. So we had the project at $378,300 already carrying forward. We're going to amend it for $1.43. The sources are the $500,000 from our regionalization reserve, the $378,000 from before, and $930,000 from grants and tax credits. So basically more than half of it will be paid for by, the rebate and the Blue Sky grant.
And we're still working with Summit County, with Emily Quinton, with the sustainability department there, seeing if there's other alternatives for more funding. So it's not like we're done looking. You know, we're still trying to see what else is out there.
When will we find out on the 40%? Not until the project happens and they buy the equipment?
Basically, yeah, I think they're going to have – I don't have a timeline on that. But
not right now. So if we pull the 500 now and then we get the 40%, maybe the county kicks in even more – and we only need 300 or whatever, then what happens to the 200? Goes back into the regionalization fund?
We could put it back in the regionalization. We could leave it in the capital budget to cover another project this year or next year. It just becomes part of the capital budget.
Okay.
That's instead of allocated, becomes unallocated and that we could redirect to someone else.
Okay. Where does our current, where does the money for our current electrical bill that we're no longer going to have to be paying, where does that money come from?
That's right out of the expense budget, so we'll have a saving, so it actually could help rates in a way, I guess, if you look at it that way.
Would that in turn get dumped back into the regionalization budget in order to compensate for where it came from, or are we just kind of horse trading here a little bit into different buckets?
We haven't thought that far on us. We're just kind of horse trading, just kind of out of a reserve bucket that we can use to spend, and actually it will drop some of the expenses over time once it's in.
Okay.
Good point.
Yeah.
Does Rocky Mountain Power cut us a check as we meter back onto it? That's what I was trying to get to, was how much power does it make?
Basically, well, you go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's sized to cover 95% of our annual usage. That's the solar array total.
Of the treatment plant.
Just that facility. You can't, with a net meter, you can't use it on stuff that's outside of the property where that net meter is.
But this also does not make us independent of Rocky Mountain Power. We still have to have the connection, so you'll still pay a minimal charge.
Yeah, we still have a small facility charge of $57 a month or whatever to be connected, plus, you know, the nominal power that we'll be using, especially during the winter months where we're not generating as much. But the other months we're going to be overproducing, so we'll create a credit for our kilowatt usage.
I'm super excited about this. I really thought the project was dying.
Yep.
We all did.
We all did, yeah.
So we'll need to get the budget amendment approved by the council. We'll need to get Promontory's final blessing on the floating solar array. But I think we will get a lot of press. And I think Ameresco will also use this as a marketing opportunity. So it will carry.
And that's why they wanted it.
Great pictures at the top of the hill with the ski mounts in the background.
Yeah.
Cody, do you have a
question? What about the ice that formed on the...
So the floats will get built into the ice, basically. They'll hold everything still for the winter. Yeah. And with the thought, you know, just knowing how that pond gets clear to the snow because of the wind, that it's going to still clear the solar panels a fair amount of the time. So obviously, right after it's formed, it's still going to be covered and it won't be generating power. But as soon as the wind blows, it's going to whip everything off most of the panels, and we'll be generating some power anyway during the winter. So,
are they going to change their pitch?
Nope, they're fixed. Okay. Yep.
We just put on solar on the house. The whole fluid output will come down. It runs for a long time and a lot of inspections.
Yep.
It's incredible. They're so thorough and so careful. It's ridiculous.
Yep.
We'll have to take out, will we have to take out a building permit?
Uh-huh. Yep, because we're getting a new meter installed. So the county will be involved in inspecting the meter before Rocky Mountain Power can put in the new meter. This one will have to be inspected.
We have to double check between the CUP.
Yeah,
I don't think we do.
That's right.
You're going to wonder about.
Yeah, we've already kind of broached the subject with the county, and we just need to go back with them now that we've kind of left sleeping dogs lie, and now we're going to be plowing ahead with it.
Is that an Ameresco's scope to get the building?
Yep.
But we'll kind of be it up for them.
Yeah, they've been awesome to work with. They've been, you know, super transparent about stuff and great to work with. So
I guess we need first the consideration for Chris's notice proceed into phase two of the design work, and then a recommendation for us to go to Summit County Council and ask for the budget amendment.
Okay, so for the first one, motion for consideration of approval to issue Ameresco notice to proceed with milestone two as described in the Mountain Regional Water contract, in addition to changing the end date to the August of 2024.
Correct.
Right.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
It's unanimous.
And then second part, consideration of recommendation to Summit County Council to approve 2023 capital budget amendment for Signal Hill Water Treatment Plant floating photovoltaic system installation.
I was the only one that could have been accepted. do we have a second? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, unanimous. Well, great work, guys. Maybe there is a benefit to being the only, you know, when looking for solar panels. And
it's been a roller coaster, to say the least. So.
Okay, with that, it is 8:11. We have a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.